Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Beer Ladies podcast. My name is Tandy, and I'm host today. I am joined today by Lisa, Carolyn, and Katie, and we're talking something that I've been confused about for so many years that we're doing this topic so that I can get this thing out of my head. We're talking about the Reinheitsgebot, which is Bavarian and German purity laws. It wasn't just one law, it was a number of them, but what we might all know as, you know, the laws that governed German brewing ingredients. And we'll get into a little bit of the context on that. But I guess before we do, let's just do a quick round the houses. Let's just, you know, get what we're drinking and get the reminder to like and subscribe and follow us on Instagram and follow us on Twitter. We're at Beer Ladies Pod pretty much everywhere. And you can even buy us a beer at buymeacoffee.com/Beer Ladies Podcast. And we'd really appreciate that. And if you haven't already, go and subscribe to our YouTube channel, which you can also find at Beer Ladies Podcast. Very simple. Go subscribe and you can even watch us. And you might even see Lisa's really awesome hat and Hofbrauhaus t-shirt in this episode. Righto. Okay, so let's start with what you're drinking and then we'll learn a little bit more about the Reinheitsgebot. And Germans, please don't come at me if I'm saying it wrong. I'm trying my best. All right, Lisa, let's start with you and your hat and your shirt.
Yeah, so I am on theme today. I've got the Hofbrau Oktoberfest. So, it's probably a little bit not quite as fresh as it should be because it's been, frankly, sitting in the back of my fridge for a while. But, I've just poured out. It's still a glorious, lovely, lovely sort of straw golden color. Very happy with it.
Wonderful. Carolyn, what have you got today, friend?
I have a live oak. They are out of Austin, Texas, and it's a Weizenbach.
Nice. Very good.
Very Katie, good and dark.
Oh, it is dark.
It is.
For those watching, it's lovely.
I am drinking a Rothaus Hefeweizen, another German, from, it just says, Rothaus im Schwarzwald. So there we go, in the Black Forest.
Wonderful. And myself, I have got a classic of the Weissbier stable. I've got Franziskaner, the Hefeweizen, and Franziskaner was one of those brands. I wasn't really sure that I liked Weiss at the beginning of my craft beer journey, in air quotes. But the Franziskaner Dunkel was the best beer probably that I'd had in such a long time. And it got me into the flavors of Weiss beer. And now whenever I see a Franziskaner, I can't help it. I just must have them. And it's very creamy and very delicious. And it's a commonly drank beer in this house anyway. So cheers, everybody. Or Prost.
Prost.
Righto. Okay, so basically we're here to learn a little bit more about the Reinheitsgebot, which is, I think the biggest thing that's weird to me, and we'll get into it, but the biggest thing that's weird to me is that it's called Bavarian purity law, German purity law, but they're not always kind of the same thing. But the basic thing, when it was brought in, and Lisa, I'm sure you're going to tell me that it was sooner than this, but the first mention I could find was 1516. And it was a law that governed beer brewing, which allowed only barley, so malted barley, water, and hops. Now, if you've been listening along to our series on ingredients, and if you know a little bit about beer, there's a really key ingredient that's missing there, and that is yeast. And I guess what I'd read anyway, but I'm sure Lisa will tell us more, is that it was kind of assumed that yeast was part of making beer, so it wasn't listed explicitly as an ingredient. But it started out, so the Reinheitsgebot started out probably partly due to trying to fix prices and supply of different ingredients across Bavaria and Germany. So if you think about it, malted barley is the biggest grain that is used in beer making even till this day. But there's many other grains that are used, for instance, wheat and rye. Now, as I understand it, the Reinheitsgebot banned wheat and rye in beer so that there was enough supply for bread makers, because those are very common bread grains. Now, I think we'll probably go through a little bit of, you know, how the Reinheitsgebot started and where it ended off and, you know, all the bits in between. But as far as I know, it governed all beer, and then it changed to only lagered beer, so only bottom fermenting beer. And then it was, then yeast was eventually added. So then it became four ingredients, not three. And then it started to allow other natural ingredients. So other things that can be found in top fermented beers, which give us Weiss and other kinds of beer, which, you know, made it, I guess, more relaxed. But now, guys, I don't know that much about it, which is why we're here and we're going to learn from the experts. So, Lisa, holy crap, man, please enlighten us about the Reinheitsgebot and where this even came from.
No, well, you're right that, you know, 1516 is the date that tends to get thrown around, but you're also absolutely correct that this is Bavaria we're talking about. This is not all of Germany. A unified Germany is not going to exist for several hundred years. And what is and is not Bavaria is also changing a lot at this point. There's always, you know, little bits and pieces coming in and going out. But I think you hit on something really important before there, where, you know, I think it's, you. I saw, and we'll put this in the show notes somewhere, but I saw a link saying, you know, it's a bread protection law rather than a beer protection law. And that's absolutely correct. It's not about, we want to brew the best beer so that people know they're getting top quality. Like, there's nothing really about quality at this point. This is all something that's kind of a sort of back formation, if you like. We'll get into a little bit how that changes in kind of the 19th and 20th century to sort of fixate on this idea that it has something to do with quality. But it's really, like you said, it's about fixing prices. It's about making sure there's a supply of wheat for, you know, for making bread, all of those good things. We don't want people to starve, but it is also too about fixing the prices of beer too, as it goes in and out. So it's really about trade. It's really about sort of import export. And again, we're talking exporting from maybe Bavaria into, you know, another part of what would eventually become Germany. You know, we're talking small distances at this point, but it's, you know, again, it's very much about, you know, making sure that we have the wheat, you know, so that you can make the bread. And I think it's interesting, so many of you have a Weiss beer or related, because that's not here at all. And it's interesting too, that the Reinheitsgebot does change over time. So it's not this sort of static thing as much as people like to sort of point to it. And I think we've probably all been in not a real German bar necessarily, but a German themed bar. Well, there'll be the Reinheitsgebot in German on the wall, as if it's this sort of, you know, handed down, you know, from the mountain kind of a thing. And it changes a lot, you know, that it goes back and forth. And it's, you know, in the 17th century, you do start to say, oh, you can use wheat in some cases. But again, you're still talking about this very limited scope of influence, if you like. And where it does get interesting later is, and I think we'll get into this a little bit, when German unification does happen, it is the Bavarian beer makers who are pushing for this to be sort of imposed, if you like, on the rest of Germany. And I think there's probably an argument there over, you know, did that sort of impact what was available then and how people brewed? Because we also know that by that point, again, we've fast forwarded a couple hundred years, that people are doing a lot of different things. There are a lot of different techniques. And what does it mean to all of those that, you know, are there some of those sort of getting shoved out of the way? But again, I think we'll get back to that, because I think there's so many little sort of bits and pieces to unpick that it's, you know, it's not a simple thing as much as people like to point to it and say, look, words, they've never changed. And of course they have. So.
And I think it's interesting, like, because Belgium has such a different beer heritage, I suppose, and it borders part of, I suppose, after Bavaria. It borders currently what we would call Germany. But obviously it wasn't initially part of Bavaria. So that region of Germany would have come under the Reinheitsgebot in what, like the 1800s, the late 1800s?
Yeah, and you certainly wouldn't be able to make, like, you know, a Witbier or anything like that if you're strictly following even the updated versions of it. And again, I think it's a really important point about the yeast is even though they don't call it out, the brewers at this time, and especially certainly once we get into the 19th century, are very much aware of, you know, you need to kind of keep your starter effectively like you would with sourdough. They know that, you know, it's not magic. This is an ingredient. This is something that they have to maintain and look after, but it's not mentioned. So it is a really interesting thing. So
I'm wondering if they're treating it something like a catalyst, like it's used in the making, but it's not consumed in the making.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Yeah. But it also gets into an interesting thing on kind of the semantics of it, because it doesn't explicitly say you can't brew these other things, but later, as it evolves, you just can't call them beer. So it's, you know, I think we see that today with kind of malt liquor and things like that, where you can't call it beer because it's too strong, or again, whatever the particular criteria we're using is. But it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting thing that people all have always found ways around, but it depends, was there a market for it?
Yeah, I remember being in Berlin about 10 years ago, and I was asking for craft beer, and they're saying, well, we don't have much craft beer, but we have all this craft ale.
Oh, that's interesting. And you think, you know, too, like, again, with sort of the changing borders that, you know, even if we're thinking about like just Bavaria, like Nuremberg, Bamberg, places like that are not part of Bavaria. And then, of course, they have very distinct beer styles that would not necessarily be up to snuff, if you like, if they were going strictly by the book, even, you know, taking the yeast to one side. So it's really, really interesting to say, you know, to kind of look and see, like, to what extent did people pay attention to it, and really what was kind of the mechanism for enforcing some of this? Like, you know, I've not found in English anyway, good primary sources that talk about people either being inspected or, you know, which must have happened. They must have had ale tasters or beer tasters or things like that that you find in other places. But, and I'm sure there are good sources in German that I've just not come across, although I did try. So I'll get to some stuff that I sloppily Google translated later. But I think it's a really interesting question of like, how much of this, is there a law because they were, you know, people were doing things that people didn't like. So it's, you know, it sort of, did it change behavior? Maybe, maybe not.
I'm wondering, could you like apply for exemptions and things like that? That'd be interesting to find out as well. Like, could you say, hey, my family have a recipe, like even back in, what was it, 1516?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Could you say, well, my family recipe has always used, I don't know, throw me an ingredient, orange, whatever.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know, can I do that? Or Rauch beer? I mean, what's consumed in that? Is it just smoky? Is it the same beer and smoke isn't really, or the...
Well, the malt would have been smoked, so maybe that almost is one of the ways that brewers would have been quite inventive with using only those three ingredients or four, depending on which time period you're talking about. And rather than looking at ingredients, looking at method and the way that you treat your ingredients as a way to differentiate. That's actually, Lisa, I wonder if you've got any views on that, because, you know, there's different styles of beer that come from different parts of what we now call Germany. And obviously different regions of what we now call Germany were different regions back then. But, you know, how does it track, you know, in terms of the beer styles that we know, which beers come from the regions that would have been Reinheitsgebotland, for lack of a better term?
Yeah.
And which are outside of that?
You see, that's a really interesting question. And I don't think I know the answer to it, but I think, you know, you can certainly take a look at sort of what has evolved elsewhere. And I think, you know, even, and this is probably slightly unfair, but even if you go to Munich, or, you know, what is still Bavaria today, you know, things are closed on Sunday. It can still be very conservative. And, you know, compared to, you know, like Berlin or somewhere different, like where I feel like so many of the, you know, what we would call kind of modern, air quote, craft brewers in Germany do tend to be in Berlin. They tend to be from Northern Germany. They're not coming from kind of the traditional sort of, you know, Bavarian heartland. That's not to say there aren't any, but they do tend to not be there. And is it still kind of that lingering, you know, sort of, is it because of the Reinheitsgebot, or is it just that it's a conservative area, relatively speaking? So I don't know. But it's also interesting, too, how some of those other traditional styles that maybe would have sort of fallen afoul, if you like, of the Reinheitsgebot that were, again, outside its traditional, if you like, area of influence, almost died out, like, you know, like a Goza or things like that, you know, that have only been revived because someone thought it was interesting. And was that related, or, and again, I think there is probably a real conversation to be had over to what extent did it kind of, you know, put a stake in the ground for German beer and say this far, but no further forward. They must all be, you know, this beautiful bright lager or even a dark lager, you know, whichever direction, but which is not to say that that's what it says in the law, because it doesn't, but, you know, to think about the impact it must have had. But again, I think a lot of this is less to do with the law, although again, there is, I think, a big impact with it around sort of German unification. But if you look at kind of the marketing of the Reinheitsgebot, when it sort of comes into its own in the 1950s, that's, I think, maybe what has driven that sort of, again, almost stagnation up until maybe the last 10 years.
Mm. So if I'm understanding, you know, the way that it came in was to regulate ingredient prices for bread makers and brewers and everybody alike. But it wasn't, or as we know, it wasn't really as enforced as what we might think, but really it's almost more of a modern notion, somewhat modern.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think
it's
taken
more seriously in a modern sense.
I think absolutely, because I did go through and read some of the sources in German again, as far as I could. And we'll link to these in the show notes, that you first have it referred to, you know, in sort of that very cliched way, as the sort of, you know, beer purity law. That doesn't happen until, I'm just looking up the exact year, 1918. So that's an entirely, you know, modern kind of spin on it. And you don't have, that doesn't even sort of come up in kind of any other context until then, again, the 1950s, when it's all about the marketing, when they're like, ah, 'twas ever thus. But I think what's so interesting about that is that, again, this is starting off as probably something very regional in terms of the marketing, that this is what we do in Germany. We've always done it that way. But then, and this is just kind of me making this up in my head, but I think there's something to this that may warrant further research, is then that gets applied to all of your macro lagers in America, Australia, where they're like, oh, well, they've always done it this way. That's what we do, guys. Even though, of course, that's
blatantly untrue. Well, I found an article about that on NPR, actually. This is 2016. Ah. So, but they, brewer Berliner Berg said they were in the US and Australia, and they were like, they decided to come back to Germany and make different beers. And they have actually used these purity laws, because Germans don't want what Americans what we're drinking. They want the purity law still in place still. So I think it's a little bit interesting that, like, even though this thing is 500 years old plus, people still want what was made 500 years ago or something similar to it. They don't want all this.
Or at least
they've
been told they want that. Yes, exactly.
Right. They don't want all this sours or gozes or whatever. Like, they don't want all the double hop IPAs. They want just a very simple beer.
But a double hop IPA is allowed, right? Because you can have as much hops as you want.
Could.
True.
And there is a distinction, again, depending on when you're looking at the law. To what extent, you know, it's more worried about your top fermenting beers versus your bottom fermenting beers, and how do they count? So you could absolutely make an IPA, you know, again, if you're following the right, you know, almost sort of choose your own adventure route that counts. But, you know, again, you have to jump through a lot of hoops. And I think one of the things I read that was so interesting was that, you know, so many German trained brewers, once they move somewhere else, again, whether that's Belgium or maybe here or to the States, they stop doing a lot of those things. They're like, you know, we don't have to do this. We can still make clean, straightforward beers, but we don't have to sort of do quite as many sort of unnecessary steps, if you like. Now, again, that doesn't mean that those aren't necessarily important in some cases, but it's interesting that a lot of people are like, but you can get the same result without.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I just think it's interesting. And they actually have a quote from like a local German guy, and he said, like, a German wants his beer made according to the purity laws. He goes, when I go on vacation, I drink wine. So, like, you know, I just thought that was a fun and interesting quote. And like, even though these things were set 500 years ago, people still want what was made 500 years ago. So I don't know. I just thought it was very interesting.
Yeah. Or have decided since they were told in the 1950s exactly. that that's what they wanted. Yeah. That, yeah. And, just, and that's, I think, so interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought it was a very interesting article. And we'll obviously link it in the show notes, but I just thought it was a very interesting article about what it is today and how it affects.
You know, I just find it like a little weird because exactly as you said, Katie, like, okay, depending on whether we're talking about lager styles, the bottom fermenting, or ale styles, top fermenting, but literally most beer in the world is made from exactly four ingredients. It's, I mean, you could have so many varieties just with those four ingredients that you wouldn't even need to write a law about it. I think what, you know, what was interesting to me about the Reinheitsgebot, at least initially, was the exclusion or at least the deliberate inclusion of only barley. And I know it changed to be malted grains and not just malted barley. And I think that was probably quite an important change in the brewing scene. But I think that was what weirded me out, I guess, because we get beers like a Weissbier, which is firstly top fermenting, so it's an ale, but secondly, it's made with wheat, at least 50% wheat. So how did that come about? Or was that just the exception? Or was it from a different part of Germany? You know, where did these kinds of beers come from then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's such a good question is how did they, you know, I think the first part is probably, yes, they were outside the area of influence initially, but then, because again, it doesn't start applying to all of Germany, depending on what we mean by Germany, until, you know, German unification. I mean, we're talking, you know, end of the 19th century is when this starts to really be meaningful to people in other parts of Germany. Although what's also interesting is it does come up again, not just because of this sort of, you know, legal of all of these different sort of regions coming together, but because of what's happening across Europe in the sort of the industrialization of brewing is you have brewers, you know, from some of the starting to be bigger German breweries going to especially England to sort of say, oh, what are they doing? They've got a lot going on and really doing some industrial espionage. Like, it's actually pretty interesting that, you know, they start to say, oh, well, we have to protect our German beer against, you know, people that might be, you know, making pale imitations, if you like, because again, we're starting to see people sell internationally. And this is, you know, where you really are starting to get people figuring out too, like how the yeast really works, all the stuff going on in, you know, in Denmark with Carlsberg and so on and so forth. But I found this really great sort of factoid, and I'm just going to have to sort of go back and translate it here because it's so interesting because it's all about this kind of, again, this industrialization and how it sort of fits in with this kind of medieval, frankly, worldview. But Gabriel Sedlmayr, who you know, also kind of invents, which I'm putting in air quotes, Märzen malt, and Märzen is kind of a packaged beer, if you like, he's been traveling around England taking notes, and he's kind of figuring out like what's happening in their big industrial breweries as they're kind of coming together. But he starts to sort of freak out basically that you know, the English are overtaking, you know, the entire European beer market because they've figured out a lot of things about transportation, you know, sort of, you know, keeping things clean, sanitation, all of these things. But that is actually one of the things that gets, you know, sort of, he sort of plants the seed, and he sort of comes back. And this is one of the things, because he's, you know, consulting with sort of, you know, your politicos and so on. So between 1871 and he's sort of, you know, trip-tropping around Europe in kind of the 1860s, 70s, between 1871 and 1906 is when the law starts to apply across Germany. So that's really, you know, not necessarily a result of like, ah, we make this good beer, we must protect it, but kind of more about corporations than the companies. Mm. So I think that's really, really interesting. But again, people kind of, you know, sort of overlook that in terms of it has to come like, oh, it's national pride. It's like, well, no, they're actually just kind of protecting their individual business. So it's pretty interesting.
It's interesting.
It's weird because it pairs with the fact that whoever took this on as like a marketing project did really, really well.
Absolutely.
It's the biggest bullshit claim I've ever seen in my whole life. Like, only made with four ingredients, as if other beer is made with other stuff. But everybody,
they even reference potato beer as being especially bad. I'm like, who was making potato beer? Come on now.
Well, obviously the Irish were. Come on, who has to be making potato beer?
I've seen.
I don't know. I have no proof.
But for real, like, I'm like, who was doing this? No one.
Oh, go ahead.
No, but like it feels like people knew actually that everybody else in the world was using those exact same ingredients, but they wanted to almost make it seem more, I don't know, pure, special, sacred, whatever the case is.
It seems to be like snobbery in a way, doesn't it? It's like, our beer is better.
Yeah.
And then I'm wondering, are there levels of snobbery? Like, is there somebody that's like, you know what? I just use natural water. I don't even like adjust the water with salts.
Or could it be, I'll drink a beer from that region, but I won't drink a beer from that region. Like, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Could it be very like, oh, I'll drink a beer from that city, but that city's beer is terrible. Like, could it have gotten down to like, per city? Like, what would you drink? Yeah, I guess. What are you going to drink that beer that city?
Is it very regional? It's almost like drink local, but not quite. Yeah.
Right.
I think there's an interesting, too, sort of, you know, the cultural context is this pops up whenever there's sort of big upheavals, if you like, because we first really see it, you know, we first again hear just the term, you know, beer purity law during the Weimar Republic, when there's all kinds going on. I mean, you know, it's not like people are like, I really hope this is the best beer I can get from Bavaria. There's all sorts of stuff going on. But then, you know, obviously some other things happen, you know, for a while. And then in the 50s, you know, post-war, you know, is when we really see this coming as kind of a marketing thing. And so I wonder to what extent it's trying to kind of build on a sort of, let's say, sort of healthier, you know, worldview, because obviously everyone's recovering from stuff that happened. How do you sort of rebuild, you know, any German product, frankly, but in, you know, 1950, say, as something that the rest of the world is going to be excited about? And I think by hearkening back to something, you know, that has the sort of, you know, sheen of a medieval past, but, you know, like, let's be real, like, it's not a great time to be alive, but, you know, it makes it sort of sound knights, you know, ye olde. Right. It sort of harkens back. And then when you tie it together with this idea of sort of pure food and drink, which again, sort of in the 50s is almost kind of going away in other places, where, you know, you look like North America, where it's like microwave food, or not quite microwave, but TV dinners early on. Spam. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's a really interesting thing where, of course, if you're, you know, in Germany, you're like, well, I don't want this crappy American beer, you know. No, like, it hadn't gotten good yet.
I'm wondering if a lot of, like, I like the way that you said there, a thing happened. Like, there would have been a lot of, we'll say, a lot of American and British people in Germany post-war. Yeah. And I'm wondering if they were like, oh, this beer tastes okay. Or this beer tastes nice. And it's like, and so then someone says, oh, they like the beer. Let's up our beer. And
yeah,
you know, absolutely. Like that. But if it was a thing that worked, and I do think, you know, you can certainly, you know, paint the picture that does plant the seeds for the eventual sort of craft beer revolution to kick off, because it's always people who are like, oh, I did, you know, I was in the army in Germany and discovered beer could be good. And, you know, and then they go back to the States or to Britain or wherever, and are like, ooh, you know, it's a really interesting thought. Although, again, I think some of that stuff, you know, some of those beers that would have been good would not be sort of Reinheitsgebot compliant. So it's an interesting, it's still an interesting dichotomy. Although I think one other thing that has just come back into my head is, the Reinheitsgebot is sort of written and signed, the original one, in Ingolstadt, which is where Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is set. So I think there's maybe something there too, just to kind of take on that kind of very sort of dark European kind of vibe about it. And I think you can make a terrible, terrible sort of, you know, analogy that it did become this sort of Frankenstein's monster of a thing that is just out there that people think they know about, but, you know, where they'll, you know, and you're like, no, it's the monster.
He's the doctor.
Yeah. Well, very good.
And
analogy well, or connection. I
almost,
like it.
Yeah. Almost.
Yeah. And I also think it's interesting that some people still think it should apply today. And like,
yeah.
With the amount of beer and people doing new things with beer, it just, it's not a bad thing. It just surprises me that people would still think that, like, oh no, like, our beer, or not everyone, but like some people are like, oh no, our beer is way better than this crap that you're drinking. But
again, triumph of marketing, really. Like if people have been convinced about this sort of purity, again, these very kind of, you know, the virtues associated with it are so interesting, where it also again ties back to, oh, it's, you know, it's food. It's not just, you know, having a drink of an evening, which again is not necessarily untrue, but it's interesting that it's tied up with all of these things that are sort of half truths. But again, that's all the best marketing, right? Is really, you know, getting that emotional connection. So
true. It's good. Good job, marketers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great job marketing as usual. I mean, marketing is responsible for the best things in the world, but I mean, it's fascinating to me because I saw there that there was a court ruling in 2005. I mean, that's very recent that, you know, German brewers could use effectively whatever they wanted in their beer, but they just can't label it as beer unless it only has those four ingredients. Now, remember, it changed to malted grains, so not just malted barley, but water, hops, yeast. But I mean, that's fascinating to me. So now we can't call it beer if it's brewed in Germany and it has a slice of orange peel in it.
So what do they call it? Like a Radler or like what?
Yeah,
I'm curious. What do they call it now? If they can't call it beer, what are they calling it?
Well, maybe that's where they've come up with their names, like a Radler, or this is a Kölsch, it's not a beer. Or is Kölsch a lager Kölsch beer?
No, Kölsch is very much a protected beer there. So it's that one adheres quite strictly even.
Yeah. Or, well, I guess maybe more like a Radler. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there because that's the only thing I can think of that would make sense.
Mm.
I don't know.
I don't know what it would be called, but I saw that one of the exceptions that are allowed is for gluten-free beer. So because you'd use different ingredients, you might use a lot of rice or maybe corn. I'm not sure. Yeah, there's no gluten in corn. So maybe you could use a bit of corn. So, I mean, those would be exceptions. It can still be called beer, but because it's gluten-free, it won't have barley and wheat.
Or maybe they're using potatoes.
you see now, if we're going to even define beer, like, are we going to say, as it should be said, that it needs grains as the base as opposed to fruit or vegetables, which would make cider or wine or spirits or a number of other things, right? I mean,
yeah, no, it's a good question, and in fact, I think one of the things that I thought was entertaining in the Wikipedia you know, article where it's, you know, it's saying, oh, well, maybe one reason this happened is, you know, to suppress the use of plants that were used in pagan rituals, such as henbane, belladonna, wormwood. I'm like, this was not happening in Bavaria in 1516. There was not some kind of pagan survival. It's a lovely idea. It wasn't happening. But I think it is interesting that you could also use some of those ingredients, though, potentially in kind of sort of birth control type things. You know, you could also induce an abortion with some of these ingredients. So maybe it wasn't about pagan ideas, but they're like, women are up to something. We're going to put the kibosh on this. So,
are we right in saying, though, because this is something that I read, but I wanted to check. Are we right in saying, though, that the purity laws or the Bavarian side of the purity laws, I guess, came from something that was a lot more, was it Roman Catholic as opposed to the Protestants in the rest of Germany?
Yeah, there's absolutely a big difference there. Yeah, because that's it. Because, you know, Northern Germany, you've got all the Lutherans doing their thing. Although, again, we're talking just before Luther, when this comes in. But, you know, it's kind of there on, you know, it's in the zeitgeist, as it were. I used a German word. But again, it is interesting is that you do have, you know, this idea that, you know, Southern Germany is getting Catholic, more conservative, even before the sort of actual Reformation happens. But then once it does happen, you know, a lot of these things, I do think this was interesting, where they're saying, oh, well, beers from Northern Germany often contain additives that couldn't be grown in Bavaria. So they're like, oh, no, that doesn't count. Sorry, not here, lads. So it's an interesting, you know, it's clearly protectionist, but it's sort of framed as this very, sort of paternalistic really thing. So very interesting. There's a lot to unpack.
What's interesting to me is I think if most people think of Germany and beer, you'll think of a variety of styles. You won't think of a country that maybe felt a little bit restricted by these kinds of rules. And yet it didn't develop in the same way that, let's say, craft brewing in the States or in England or anywhere else developed. So it didn't follow the same path, even though it was technically allowed the same ingredients. So what on earth is that about?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because like you say, even if you look at, you know, neighbors in, say, Germany, in Belgium, where it's all happening, so much variety, and then sort of in Germany, it seems much more, again, staid rule following, which again, you play into national stereotypes, which is unfair, but it is an interesting, it is interesting. And I think, to what extent is that still sort of driven by the kind of economics of, you know, that, like, were there sort of very protectionist or other, you know, kind of policies that led to saying, well, this sells, let's just stick with this, versus letting people or encouraging maybe people to experiment. And I think too, there is probably a difference between, you know, Germany really industrializes brewing. It all is still much smaller, not all, but most is still much smaller, sort of more localized in Belgium, where, you know, you have every sort of town and village doing their own thing. You know, it still is kind of much more of a cottage industry, whereas, you know, Germany sort of is like, ooh, we can have railways and make this all work and get this stuff everywhere. So I wonder if it's a combination of those two things. And then once they realize they can use this as a marketing tool as well, just start slapping on, you know, bottles and be like, look, we did the thing.
And do any other countries have, or have they had, strict brewing laws like that, I wonder, or anything like that?
Good question. I don't know offhand. I do know that there were other things that did predate the Reinheitsgebot that, again, were very regional, very, you know, very sort of small. I mean, there are certainly antecedents in Scandinavia, but again, we're talking Viking period. This is not kind of something we would necessarily be able to say, yes, we know those ingredients and, you know, what they were. But that's an interesting question. Well, the Viking ones are fascinating. But
as I understand, some breweries in some countries that were not in Germany or surrounds even adopted the Reinheitsgebot for themselves, which is, again, a crazy marketing win. But but why on earth would breweries outside of Bavaria or outside of Germany, like, even adopt this? But I mean, even Windhoek breweries in Namibia claim to be like Reinheitsgebot compliant. I mean,
but Namibia was a German colony.
That's true.
So I'm a lot of that came from
No,
the colonial,
you're 100%
overmasters,
right.
Saying,
yeah,
this is,
and
the
I think you see that
beer.
In Argentina as well. There are certainly places that had a lot of immigrants, and, you know, from Germany, and that's probably, you know, it, they recognized it as a sort of, you know, brand from home, if you like. Mm.
Yeah, so I mean, that one might make sense. But I'd seen, I think, somewhere in one of these articles that even a brewery in China, was it Tsingtao, claims to follow the Reinheitsgebot.
But I mean,
inadvertently, everybody's generally following it, unless you're adding donuts to your beer. It's just that you're not putting it on your bottle.
Right, right.
Yeah. Exactly. Or Lucky Charms. Yeah. Like, no Lucky Charms. Sorry.
The U.S. does some interesting stuff with beer, so
that is true. I did have the Lochgill Chuck E. Larms beer, which was very interesting, and I've had a couple of them now. But you know, you're right though, and I can definitely think of some in both the U.S. and Canada that make it a big selling point of we do the thing. But I think it's also interesting that I think some of them that really do kind of, you know, sort of wave that banner are doing nothing of the sort, because they've got all that rice in there. So it's, you know, it's so interesting.
Yeah.
You know, some are just like, you know, no, sure, it's true. Well, why wouldn't it be? You're like, well, okay.
Like rice and corn. Are they the blind spots of the Reinheitsgebot? Like,
because now they're grain, right? So it's all
they're
fine
grain.
Now.
Are they malted? I don't know.
That's a good question. Yeah. And again, I think, you know, there's a whole other discussion there on sort of the historical use in North America of corn, especially, and why that was, why it's not a bad thing in air quotes, and why adjuncts can be perfectly good. But it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't fit that whole narrative at the same time.
Yeah.
This just popped up. It says 5 things you didn't know about the, I'm going to butcher it. So
the Rhinehouse.
The UK, German, say, yeah. German, it says many traditional German beers do not follow the original Bavarian purity laws. As an example, a Hefeweizen. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's like half of the styles that we know from Germany don't follow the original version of the law. So that's why I was always really confused about this thing. Because the beers that we know are German or German styles and the law that is supposedly governing beer production, like they don't square up. I guess knowing that it changed, you know, to be malted grains, not just malted barley, but it's still, I just think
it's still very present law to some people, I guess. Like, I don't know how else to put that.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. Yeah. And certainly, like, if you go to Munich, you know, they have sort of, you know, big signs out in, you know, where the Oktoberfest happens to be like, look, we have the thing. Yay.
Yeah.
Even though, but again, you know, certainly, you know, your key Munich breweries are 100% doing it. But I also, I wonder to what extent, and I think I would love to sort of dive into their archives and find out more, because I suspect it's all sort of Spaten who kind of made this happen as a sort of marketing thing.
Oh, so about craft beer styles. They are forced to label their creation as ales or malt beverages.
Uh-huh.
There we go. So there's our answer.
That's right. There's
our answer. So that's how we probably got ale.
No, that makes sense. And definitely when I get, you know, the sort of bizarre stuff from Berlin that pops up in shops here in Dublin from time to time, I have noticed some of them are labeled in a very unique ways. Yeah. So
there's our answer to the question we asked a little while ago.
But it's amazing, because there was clearly nothing wrong with German ingenuity and German creativity, because, you know, the types of beers that we have gotten from Germany over the years are amazing. I mean, we're not just talking about one kind of lager in the whole world. You know, we're talking about all the alt beers and the Weizenbocks and the Märzens and the Dunkels and the Schwarz beers, and there's so many different kinds. And even if they only include 3 or 4 ingredients, I mean, it's incredible what people can do. Yeah,
look at all you can do with that. And I think I think Bock is having a moment, I think, just now, in the same way that mild is in kind of, you know, sort of in a couple of different places. I think Bock is also having that, both in sort of, well, maybe more in North America than actually in Germany. But I think it's, you know, it's such a great beer. And again, perfect week when it's been a really cold spring, like, oh, you know, lovely to have a Bock and just feel a little warmer and look at some cute pictures of goats on it. You
know, I was gonna say, like, buy them for the goats if nothing else. I'm such a fan of goats.
I know, the goats are adorable.
We love German beer, guys. We don't hate German beer, by the way.
Oh, we love it. I'm on my second one and it's a school night, so come on.
It's half term, it doesn't count. It's all good.
I still have to get up for work in the morning.
No.
I didn't take it off. Well, actually, I have Thursday and Friday off this week.
There you are.
There we are.
All good.
Yeah, but, I've been doing a bit of research myself. So there we go.
And I would wonder, you know that amazing classic movie that everybody has to watch, Beer Fest? And the old, have you not seen this, Tandy?
No.
I have not seen it. It's been on my list for a long time. I just keep on forgetting that it exists.
This sounds like a teenage movie.
It is a bit of a teenage movie. But it's so good. It's so good.
It's fun.
They go looking for Gam Gam's recipe for her beer, and I'm hoping that it's a Rheinheitsgebot, because it's a family recipe all the way from Germany that they have to brew for the competition, isn't it?
Yeah.
There it is.
I'll have to find it.
It's one of the films.
They do the Beer Olympics in it, kind of. And it's so good. They have to go through, like, they have to go to Munich where the Oktoberfest is going on, but really behind the scenes, there's this secret brewing game, drinking games, and you have like the Irish team and you have Scandinavian teams and the British, and they're all like, they do like the, they have to do the boot. And they have, that's, you know, good. Like the boat where you do it, put it on your head, and the next person drinks. So they have all these beer pong. So they have to take part in all of these games. So they're obviously on the American team, but yeah, it's really, really fun. It's not a historical.
But you know what it's good for is it's a good as part of a double bill if you're warming up for Eurovision. Just saying,
Fire
just
Saga.
Previewing for people. We will of course have another Eurovision episode in a few weeks' time. But I'm straight.
And can I just say that my favorite entry so far has qualified at the weekend before we recorded this?
Is it Norway?
Yeah.
Oh God, I love it.
Give the wolf a banana.
That's mad. Guys, you're gonna have to tune in for Eurovision craziness. Because this particular Beer Ladies cohort, we're generally obsessed with Eurovision and all of the drama and all of the pizzazz that comes with it.
Absolutely. All the sparkles, all the costumes being ripped off. We are here for it. So we're just, you know, we're letting you know now. Mm-hmm. Be prepared.
Eurovision is coming. It is coming. And Carolyn, you won't even be left out for that long since the States is doing a Eurovision at some stage too.
Oh, yeah. I'll see how that goes. That'll be interesting.
I'm totally going to be watching with popcorn. Are you kidding me?
It's going to be amazing. So dark. Wait. Kelly Clarkson.
Oh, yes. This is going to be magical. With Snoop Dogg and Kelly Clarkson. Like, I love both of them. This is going to be like Snoop Dogg's going to be like, well, we already know. And Kelly Clarkson is a very loud personality, so I'm curious. Not in a bad way, in a good way. Yeah. I love her.
Probably an Aries like me, right?
It'll be interesting to see those two together. So now I'm actually curious. I did not know this.
And I'm wondering what are the kind of musics that they're going to have? We're on a segue there. Yeah.
Total segue. But hey, listen, Germany also produces some very interesting Eurovision entries. Last year was particularly cool. Yes. we'll just continue with all of that now. But guys,
to love Jendrick. He didn't poll very well, but you know.
He tried. Guys, is there anything else now on the Reinheitsgebot or purity laws in general that we have missed out? Is there anything that our folks listening at home will need to know before we leave this?
It's a good question. I think there's just, I think that the big question is, again, who sort of perpetuated all this starting in the 1950s? That's what I would love to know more about. Again, if it were here, you could go to Guinness and, you know, dig through the archives and find out like what was the advertising campaign, but what kicked it off in Germany? That's what I would love to know more about. So anyone German listening, let us know.
Well, and then I kind of want to know what made them revive it in like the 1950s. Yeah. Why did they pick that? I mean, it just seems very interesting. Mm. Yeah,
absolutely.
And so, also on German unification, like when Bismarck was like, let's all come together and we'll be one happy family. And it's like, why did all the northern states agree to it?
Exactly.
We have a lot of questions.
We do have a lot of questions. And why did Bavaria even make it like a condition for reunification? I mean, why was it that important?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Absolutely. Why can you still not go to a shop in Munich on a Sunday? That's a whole other question.
Mad.
You can drink at Oktoberfest on a Sunday, though, just in case anybody's there on a Sunday. You can get beer. You're fine.
All good.
This is the real knowledge.
We're here to help.
Okay. Well, let's leave it there then, friends. If anybody on Twitter or on Instagram or within our sort of podcast purview wants to help us out with some of our unanswered questions, please send us an email at the beerladiespodcast@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter. We're at beerladiespod and same on Instagram. We're on Facebook too. I think we're at beerladiespodcast on Facebook. And you can buy us a beer at buymeacoffee.com/beerladiespodcast. But yep, that's it for the Reinheitsgebot and its excellent marketing campaign. I guess that's what we know it is now. It's really kind of just that, since most beer is only ever made from four ingredients anyway. All right. Thank you, friends, for being here tonight. And thank you at home for listening to the Beer Ladies podcast. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.